We guessed one of us couldn't have children, and we were already talking about adopting by then. We had one go at IVF, in vitro fertilization, and then approached our social services about adopting. We soon learned that we were considered too old to adopt a baby or young child. Ian was 39 then, and I was 35. Time passed, and we'd almost resigned ourselves to not having a family, and then by chance I saw a story in the news about a couple who'd adopted from abroad. I started researching international adoption and found it had been going on for years all over the world. Orphaned and abandoned children who couldn't be looked after in their own country matched with couples abroad who wanted to adopt. You can imagine our joy. It seemed the answer to our prayers. Not only would we have the family we so dearly wanted, but we would be saving a young child from a life in an orphanage. Elaine stopped, and overcome with emotion, wiped a tear from her eye. Chapter 24 A Family Torn Apart. The process to adopt from abroad is long and complicated, Elaine continued when she felt able. We had to be passed to adopt in this country first, which involved many visits from a social worker who asked lots of searching and personal questions. She then wrote our home study report while we attended the training and preparation course. Then there were police checks, references, bank and personal, and we both had to have medicals. After that, we had to go before a panel of 10 people who asked us questions about our reasons for wanting to adopt and what we thought we could give a child. I was so nervous, my hands were trembling, but we passed. Our papers were then sent to the Department for Education and a certificate of eligibility was issued. That was the proof we were allowed to adopt. I still have it. She paused and threw me a small, sad smile. How long ago that seems now, she nodded thoughtfully. After we'd been accepted to adopt, it was up to us to get in touch with an adoption facilitator in the country we wanted to adopt from. By then, I'd done a lot of research on the internet and had joined an online support group for international adoption. The members were very helpful. They had either adopted from abroad themselves, so knew what to do, or were going through the process and were willing to share their experiences. If I had a question about procedure or the next step, one of them would help. Because our paperwork was going abroad, it all had to be notarized by a solicitor here first and then legalized by our Foreign and Commonwealth Office. After that, we had to send it to the facilitator in the country we were adopting from and pay to have it translated and legalized in that country. Weeks, sometimes months, passed in between, when all we could do was wait and hope. You try to think of other things and resist the temptation to keep phoning, but it's there with you the whole time. It's the biggest life-changing decision you ever make, but we were never in any doubt it was the right one for us. While we waited, we got the nursery ready and bought baby clothes and toys. You can't leave it until the last minute, although it's a strange feeling shopping for baby things when there is no sign of a baby. If you're expecting, you have the proof inside you. Your stomach swells and you can feel it move, so you know that the nursery, clothes and toys will be used in time. But when you're adopting, there is nothing but faith and hope. You are completely reliant on others. I tormented myself with the possibility it might not happen and the nursery would remain empty forever. Ian's parents weren't much good. They kept trying to put us off. But my sister was supportive, and so were our online friends. Then, after all those months of waiting, we got the call. Dr. Chiabanu, our adoption facilitator, phoned us at home one evening and said a baby girl had been left at the orphanage and was free for adoption. Can you imagine our joy? It was the best feeling ever. Our baby had arrived. He sent a photograph and we immediately fell in love with little Lana. Lana? I queried. Elaine nodded somberly and continued. We confirmed straight away we wanted to adopt her, and the following week we were on the plane. I'd had our bags partially packed for some time, knowing that now all our paperwork was in, we could get the call any time and would have to leave as soon as possible. On the plane, I kept looking at the photo of Lana, the proof our baby was real, at the orphanage and waiting for us. We began bonding with her from the moment we received her details. Our happiness was indescribable. We took photographs of our adoption journey, and I kept a journal so that our baby would know her route, just as the social worker had said we should. It was late when the plane arrived, and we went straight to our hotel and to bed. Dr. Chiabanu knew what time our flight was due in, and had said we should go to the orphanage the following morning to meet him and our baby. Needless to say, we didn't sleep much that night. We were far too excited. We were up early, but I couldn't eat breakfast. I just wanted to go to the orphanage and see my baby. We'd booked a cab through the hotel reception to take us to the orphanage. I can still remember that journey, our joy, our hopes and expectations that very soon we would be a family and our lives would be complete. We were let into the orphanage by a care worker who said Dr. Chiabanu had been called away. She then told us our baby was dead, and we should choose another one. Just like that. "Oh, no," I gasped. "That's dreadful. I'm so sorry. I had no idea." Elaine's eyes glistened with tears. "It was awful. Bad enough our baby had died, but it was made worse by her heartless behaviour. Not, 'I'm sorry to have to tell you your baby has passed,' just, 'She's dead. You choose another one.' After, I wondered if her harshness might have been due to her limited English, but her manner was cold. I mean, you can show compassion in ways other than words." I nodded. "Anna doesn't know about Lana. We didn't want her thinking she was second best, so please don't tell her." "No, of course I won't." There was no reason why I should tell Anna, as it didn't directly affect her. My thoughts flashed to Anna's life storybook and the memory box I'd unpacked and looked through before putting away. I now realized there was a far more painful backstory, which for good reason Elaine and Ian had decided not to tell Anna. Elaine then told me of the dreadful conditions they'd witnessed in the orphanage, and my eyes welled. I'd read about those orphanages in newspapers and had seen pictures on the television, but hearing about them firsthand moved me deeply. "No words can describe our heartache and disappointment at losing Lana, and we just wanted to go home. We wouldn't try to adopt again. Clearly we weren't meant to have children. We were going to bring forward our flight home, but then late that evening, Dr. Chiabanu telephoned us at the hotel and apologized for what had happened. He asked us to go to the orphanage the following day, as he had another child for us who was a bit older but very healthy. Ian and I spent the whole night talking about what we should do and decided to go the following day. We had nothing to lose, and of course this new child needed a home as much as Lana had done. It was obvious as soon as we met Anna, or Anastasia, as she was then, that she was very different from Lana. At 2 1/4, she was very lively and robust and obviously healthy. Dr. Chiabanu wasn't a bad man, but with so few resources and only 2 care workers, the level of care at the orphanage was very low, and there was a limit to what he could do. We decided to go ahead and adopt Anna, and we saw her at the orphanage every afternoon while Dr. Chiabanu prepared our adoption application for the court there. We quickly bonded with Anna. She was feisty then and knew her own mind, but just when we thought everything was on track again, there was a problem. "Oh, no. What happened?" "Nothing to Anna, but it was the height of summer, and with most judges on holiday, we couldn't get a court date for 3 months. Anna's mother needed to work and took a job abroad for that period, and we reluctantly returned home. The thought of Anna in the orphanage for all that time was very worrying, but there was nothing we could do. Dr. Chiabanu promised us she'd be well looked after. We flew back on the 18th of November a few days before the court hearing and went straight to the orphanage to see Anna. Dr. Chiabanu was there and brought Anna to us. Her first words were, "Mummy and Daddy." Can you imagine that? I hugged her, but even then I remember thinking how stiff and unresponsive she was. She clearly remembered us, but didn't show any affection. She never has. We saw Anna every afternoon at the orphanage until the court date. Did we spoil her? Yes, definitely. Did she always have her own way? That was one of the questions the psychologist I eventually took her to asked. Yes, she did. We showered her with gifts and did exactly what she wanted. We'd waited so long for a child, and Anna had led such a miserable life. Why wouldn't we want to make her happy? Did we realise how badly damaged she was by her early years experience? No, and we assumed that whatever had happened could be put right with our love and kindness. We met her mother for the first time in the court waiting room. She was a small woman dressed in thick woolens and a headscarf. She looked sad, and we felt very sorry for her, naturally. We couldn't talk to her because of the language barrier, but we thought she was very brave and selfless to put her daughter first and want a better life for her. It was only later, when we were home and Anna had learned more English, that we discovered her mother had beaten her and locked her in a cellar at night. Little wonder Anna won't sleep in her own bed. She does now, I added. Does she? She wouldn't for us, Elaine said quietly, and I could have kicked myself for being so thoughtless. Elaine then told me of the very difficult first week they'd had with Anna in the hotel, when she wouldn't settle, eat, or sleep properly. We thought she would settle once we were home, and she did start eating. But the poor kid had worms, and had to be treated for that. Otherwise, she was physically healthy. It was her behaviour and attitude to us that caused the problems. Far from improving, it went from bad to worse. Every little thing was a challenge, and she was so angry most of the time. She still is. To begin with, she refused to learn English, and would never do anything we asked or wanted to do. It felt as though she was rejecting us, and it hurt. We thought she'd be pleased to have parents, a nice home, and a room of her own. But when she started using English, she said she liked the orphanage more than us, and other hurtful things. Then she'd watch for my reaction to see if I was upset. I couldn't take her anywhere for fear she'd have a tantrum, which I wouldn't be able to control. Eventually, I stopped trying to go out. If Ian was with me, it was a little easier, but he was embarrassed too. The children our friends had were usually well-behaved if they were out or had visitors. So too were my nieces and nephew. Anna seemed to take delight in doing the wrong thing and would only ever do what she wanted. She was vicious at times, still is, hurting me and other children at nursery and then school. As she grew, her problems increased. She became sly, manipulative, defiant, and always so angry. It sounds awful talking about her like this, but it's true. It was relentless and wore Ian and me down and forced us apart. Anna came between us. We weren't even allowed to sleep in the same bed or have a minute to ourselves. Anna never smiled, she still doesn't, or wanted a cuddle. In fact, I'm sure she never wanted us. She seemed pleased when Ian left just after Christmas, as though she had won. But then, of course, all her rage was aimed at me. Elaine stopped. Didn't you think to ask for help? I asked. Oh, I did, many times. I went to the doctor and we paid to see a psychologist privately, more than one. That's when Anna was diagnosed with reactive attachment disorder. When the psychologist explained the causes and effects, it made perfect sense. It was Anna. The neglect and abuse she'd suffered as a baby and young child, and of course us having to leave her for 3 months added to this. We couldn't afford to pay for her to have therapy privately. It would have gone on for years, and there was a long waiting list for a referral under the National Health Service. Ironically, her being in care seems to have speeded up the process. As you know, she has been referred. I nodded. Where is Ian now? I asked. Staying with his parents. I was already worn down with trying to look after Anna, and after Ian left, her behaviour got worse. It came to a head one day when Anna had been particularly spiteful at school, and I had to collect her early. I told her off and sent her to her room when we got home. I was surprised she went. She never normally did as I told her. I left her for a while and then went up. She wasn't in her room, but in my bedroom. I had a drawer in there containing my parents' personal effects, their watches, spectacles, some costume jewellery of Mum's, a few ornaments they'd collected on their holidays, personal things that reminded me of them, and a photograph album. I'd shown Anna them once when I'd tried to talk to her about losing your parents. She'd broken everything that was breakable and had ripped up the photographs of Mum and Dad. I was so angry and upset, I nearly hit her. I'd never been that close to hitting her before. Then I began crying uncontrollably. I sat there among my parents' broken keepsakes and wept. Anna just looked at me without any compassion or sorrow, and I knew then I'd reached the end. I telephoned the duty social worker. I'd had the number ready for a while, intending to phone to ask for help, but I broke down and sobbed and said they needed to take her. She paused. The rest you know. Anna came into foster care. Elaine looked at me with guilt in her eyes. I know this sounds awful, but I was pleased when the first two foster carers couldn't cope with Anna's behaviour. It proved it wasn't just me. But you seem to be doing all right, so I suppose it must be me. No, absolutely not, I said firmly. I've had many years' experience looking after children with challenging behaviour, but I can tell you that Anna's behaviour has stretched me to the limit. Really? Elaine asked, surprised. But she's improved so much since she's been here. It was my turn to look surprised. Has she? I asked. You can see that. Can't you? Not really. And for the first time, we both allowed ourselves a smile. Well, that is reassuring, I said. But where to go from here? Elaine had told me so much and raised many issues that had combined to tear their family apart. She and Ian had been ill-equipped to look after a child like Anna, who'd had such a damaging start in life, and from the sound of it, they'd had little or no professional help and support, added to which they'd lost their first child, Lana, and hadn't had a chance to grieve for her before going straight into Anna's adoption. Then there was the matter of how they'd set about managing Anna's behaviour. They'd felt sorry for her, who wouldn't, so had spoilt her and given her everything she wanted to try to heal the wounds from her past, but in so doing had fuelled her challenging behaviour. I'd fostered children before who believed they were in charge, usually because they'd had to be at home with parents unable to function as a result of alcoholism or drug abuse. Part of changing that behaviour was to take away the responsibility and control they'd assumed and place them in the role of a child again. That's what I'd been doing with Anna, as well as putting in place boundaries for good behaviour, reinforcing and repeating them endlessly. Even so, Anna had so many issues that would need professional help. "Are you in touch with Ian?" I asked tentatively after a moment. "I am now. I phone him after I've seen Anna here and tell him how she is. He's struggling. He's lost me, just as I've lost him." "And you've both lost Anna," I pointed out. Her eyes filled. "I know. And I haven't a clue what to do about it, and neither has Ian." Chapter 25 Ian Elaine left shortly after. She thanked me for listening and said she'd see me as usual on Saturday. I didn't know if I'd been of any help. I hadn't said much, but hopefully just listening so that Elaine could tell her story had unburdened her and helped. I collected Anna from school at 2 o'clock, and the rest of the afternoon and evening passed as normal. Or normal for us now, with me spending 90% of my time making sure Anna did as she was supposed to and didn't get up to mischief. While I could view some of Anna's behaviour as mischief, there was other behaviour that was cruel and destructive. Trashing Elaine's treasured keepsakes of her parents, for example, was malicious. There's no other word for it. An act of mindless violence, unless you took into account Anna's past. Then you could see the logic of a 5-year-old damaged child. Anna had suffered as a result of not having loving parents, so why shouldn't Elaine suffer too? If only Anna could be made to see that she was now loved and cared for, hopefully some of her anger and destructiveness would go. Of some reassurance was that Elaine had seen improvement in Anna's behaviour, and I was very pleased that my relentless efforts not only to modify Anna's behaviour, but to try to make her feel wanted and cherished, were having some success. That evening, when I wrote up my log notes, I wrote only that Elaine had visited and talked about Anna's adoption. There was no need for me to go into all the detail, although I might when I next spoke to Jill or Laurie. The week rushed by, and on Thursday afternoon, Mrs. Taylor made a point of seeing me in reception while I waited for Miss Rich to bring Anna to me at 2 o'clock. I usually arrived a few minutes early, as I allowed extra time for traffic. Mrs. Taylor asked me how my family and I were, and then said, "I was wondering if Elaine had had a chance to speak to you in private." "Yes," I said, slightly surprised she knew. "She visited me on Monday." "Good. I told her to have a chat with you. I thought it might help. I've also given her the telephone number of my sister, Flo, the one who adopted boys." "Okay, good," I said. "How was Elaine when you saw her? I'm not asking you to break a confidence, but how was she in herself?" "Struggling to see a way forward," I replied honestly. "She's in touch with her husband now, which gives me some hope." "Yes, she is." Although I wasn't sure this was a sign of hope that the family could be reunited, which I assumed was what Mrs. Taylor meant. She thanked me for all I was doing for Anna and told me to keep up the good work, then went to rejoin her class. Mrs. Taylor's care and concern for her pupils' welfare went far beyond her role as a teacher. I was expecting something different from Elaine on Saturday after she'd unburdened herself on Monday, thinking she might be more confident and positive in dealing with Anna, but to my disappointment she was exactly the same. Anna was her usual rude and demanding self, and Elaine let her walk all over her, not once stopping or correcting her, even when she pinched her and shouted in her face. So it was left to me to tell Anna. Even Adrian and Paula were now standing up to her, for example, by saying, "No, Anna, don't snatch," when she took something they were playing with. But Elaine didn't censure her once. When the hour was up, Elaine never stayed longer. I saw her to the front door while Anna remained in the living room. "You know, Elaine," I said, "our foster carer training teaches us that putting in place boundaries for good behaviour is a sign we care, that we want what's best for the child. Anna won't love you any less if you correct her sometimes." "She doesn't love me now," Elaine said bluntly. "She never has." "Of course she does, but part of her condition is that she can't show it. Therapy should help." Elaine shrugged and, saying goodbye, left, clearly unconvinced. I'd been trying to teach Anna kindness and affection by stroking our cat gently, for example, rather than screaming in its face or trying to pull its ears and tail. I also hoped that by setting a good example, the way my family and I treated each other with respect and consideration would help, but any advance I made was undone by Elaine allowing Anna to treat her so badly. Perhaps Elaine felt guilty and that she deserved to be treated this way, but it wasn't healthy and was creating double standards, which would be confusing for Anna. On Sunday I invited my parents to dinner again, and they too said they could see some improvement in Anna, although it seemed to me that I spent most of the day correcting her behaviour. I'd found before that when we had visitors, she upped her negative behaviour, being demanding, attention-seeking and in their faces, not doing what I'd asked and sometimes being over-familiar with our guests. I knew that this over-familiarity was part of Anna's attachment disorder, and I dealt with it quickly and quietly, moving her away from the guest, putting myself between them, or taking her off their lap. Jill visited on Tuesday for one of her supervisory meetings, during which time I told her some of what Elaine had said about Anna's adoption. She said she'd pass it on to Laurie. As my supervising social worker, Jill was in direct and regular contact with the child social worker. "I spoke to Laurie yesterday," she said. "She's been trying to contact Elaine, but she's not returning her calls. She's left messages on her voicemail and answer phone. The social services won't leave Anna here indefinitely," which I knew. "When you see Elaine, can you tell her it's important she gets in contact with Laurie?" "Yes, I will." So on Saturday, when Elaine visited, I took her to one side, out of earshot of the children, while Anna was busy rummaging in the toy cupboard. "Elaine, my supervising social worker, Jill, was here this week and said Laurie has been trying to contact you." "I know. She keeps leaving messages. You need to call her back as soon as possible." I don't think she understood the importance. "I don't want to talk to her right now." "Well, you have to. If you don't, then decisions could be made without you being involved. Laurie won't leave Anna here indefinitely. It's not fair on her. She needs to know where she's going to live permanently." Elaine looked quite worried. "Also, therapy is unlikely to start until Anna is settled in her permanent home, wherever that is." "I've had a letter from CAMS," she said. "Anna has an appointment with the therapist next week." "Oh, that's come through quickly. Are you going to take her?" "I thought you would." I wondered when she was going to tell me. "Okay, but I'll need the details of where and when." "I'll phone you with them." "And you need to let Laurie know. Promise me you'll phone her first thing on Monday." "I will." "Don't put it off any longer," I emphasized. Elaine wouldn't be the first parent who had failed to engage with their social worker and found their child the subject of a court order. At present, Anna was in care voluntarily, so her parents retained full parental rights, which was probably why the letter for the appointment had been sent to her rather than to me or the social services. If the social services were granted a full care order by the court, Elaine and Ian would lose their parental rights and have to go to court to try to win them back. Although, of course, they'd only do that if they were fighting to keep Anna, and at present, I wasn't sure they would. I didn't like the fact that Elaine had asked me to take Anna to the appointment. It was as though she'd completely given up. However, situations can and do change quickly in fostering. On Monday morning, I let Jill know that Anna's appointment at CAMS had come through and that Elaine had asked me to take her, and I was waiting to hear what day and time it was. Jill said she'd let Laurie know. An hour or so later, Elaine telephoned, I assumed to give me the details of the appointment. "It's on Wednesday," she said, "but you needn't take her. Ian and I are going to." Oh, good," I said, surprised but pleased. That sounded positive. "Have you told Laurie?" "Yes, the appointment is at 3 o'clock, so we are going to collect Anna from school at 2 and go straight there. We'll bring her back to you after, I'm guessing around 5 o'clock. Laurie asked if you could explain to Anna what is happening, as she won't see her before." "Yes, of course." In Elaine's words, I caught sight of a very different person, one who could organise and make requests, before her dreams had been shattered and she'd been beaten down by the relentless demands of a very challenging child. "Excellent," I said. "Can I ask what made you change your mind about taking Anna to the appointment?" A couple of things, really. After you said the social services wouldn't leave Anna with you indefinitely and might apply for a court order, I phoned Ian and told him. He was worried too. I then returned Laurie's calls and she sort of confirmed what you'd said and said that if we are working towards Anna returning home in the future, then we need to be part of Anna's therapy. I also phoned Mrs. Taylor's sister, Flo. She has 2 adopted sons. She was helpful.
Good.
Although, you know, therapy can take months before you see any improvement. I didn't want her and Ian thinking it was a quick fix. I know, we'll see how it goes, but can I ask you something?
Sure.
I sent Anna's life story book a memory box in her belongings. What did you do with them? I've never seen them at your house.
I unpacked them and put them safely away.
So they are not on view in Anna's bedroom?
No, but if she asks for them, I can easily get them out. Is that okay? She hasn't asked for them yet.
Elaine was silent for some moments. Is that all right? I asked again.
Yes, Flo did similar with her lads. I should have, but I was so keen to follow the advice of the social worker about keeping the child's roots alive that I think I've caused some of Anna's problems. Flo said they'd been put under a lot of pressure to do the same and stay in touch with the boy's natural parents, even though her lads didn't want to. She and her husband refused, but I've been talking to Anna about her mother almost as if she was there. It was me who kept bringing up the subject of her past and suggested we kept looking at her life story book and going through the memory box. Anna wasn't interested, but I thought I was doing the right thing. I always referred to Anna's birth mother as her mummy. Little wonder she resented me and hasn't bonded with us.
I heard her voice break. Elaine, you can't blame yourself. Perhaps with hindsight you may have done things differently, but that's the nature of having children. We can only do our best and learn from our mistakes. Anna has other issues arising from being abused and neglected in her early years, which have never been properly addressed. Therapy should help.
I hope so. I was so pleased I talked to Flo. She spoke a lot of good sense. She invited us over to meet her family. She said her favourite saying, which she shared with her boys, is, "You can't start the next chapter of your life if you keep rereading the last one." That's so true.
Yes, indeed it is, I said. I remembered that quote, and years later, when I fostered and then adopted Lucy, whose story I tell in Will You Love Me, I used it with her. Those few words seem to sum up so much for children and adults who are struggling to move on from a difficult past. I made a note in my diary of the arrangements for Wednesday, and when I collected Anna from school that afternoon, I took the opportunity of the two of us being alone in the car to tell her that her mummy and daddy would be collecting her on Wednesday, and the three of them would go to see a therapist at the hospital. I explained that a therapist was a type of doctor who would talk to them, ask questions, and probably play some games. Most therapy involving children includes therapeutic games. Anna was uncharacteristically quiet as I spoke, and didn't keep interrupting or talking over me, or covering her ears so she couldn't hear, which she still often did. I glanced at her in the rearview mirror. "Are you okay? Any questions?"
"No."
"Well, if you do think of any, ask me and I'll do my best to answer." Anna continued to be subdued for the rest of the afternoon and evening, so much so that I asked her a few times if she was all right and she nodded. On a lighter note, I overheard Adrian remark casually to Paula in his old-fashioned way, "I think Anna may have turned a corner. We can only hope." I smiled at Adrian's dry sense of humour. At bedtime, having clearly been thinking about things, Anna finally had a question, and it stopped me in my tracks.
"Are my mummy and daddy going to send me back?"
"To the orphanage?" I asked, horrified. She nodded.
"No, of course not. They adopted you. You are their daughter, and they are your parents,"
I said yet again.
"There is no changing that, even if you are not living with them," although I could see why she might think it. "Are you sure?" she asked.
"Yes, positive. Why?"
"I used to tell them I wanted to go back, and they always do as I say, but I don't really."
Which was a very good example of why children shouldn't be given too much power. It's a frightening place to be, as they don't have the maturity to deal with it. "Well, luckily for you,
Adults don't always do as you tell them, I said, including me, Laurie and your parents.
Anna looked at me carefully and then climbed into bed. I always tucked her in, even though she didn't want a hug or kiss goodnight.
Do you think I'm wicked?
She asked, resting her head on the pillow.
No, you are not wicked. You make the wrong choices sometimes. The therapist will help you learn how to make the right choices.
The kids at school think I'm horrible.
No, you're not horrible, Anna. But to make friends, you have to be kind to other children. Share and ask if you can join in, then play nicely. I'm sure you can do it if you try.
I don't know how to, she said wistfully.
Will the therapist teach me to be nice?
My heart went out to her. It was part of her attachment disorder that she didn't know how to treat other children or adults. This was the longest, most meaningful conversation we'd had since she'd arrived, and I caught a glimpse of a very isolated, fragile and hurting child.
Yes, I'm sure the therapist will be able to help you, I said with a reassuring smile. But in the meantime, you could think how you like to be treated and do the same to others. That would be a good start. I wanted to give her a hug, but when I took her hand in mine, she pulled it away.
Is there anything else you want to ask then?
Can I sleep in your bed?
She asked, perhaps thinking our heart-to-heart had lessened my resolve.
No, love, we've been through that,
which she accepted. She snuggled down and I tucked in the covers, remembering only too clearly all those nights I'd been up repeatedly returning her to her bed. But it was an investment that had paid off.
Night, love. See you in the morning, I said.
As usual, Anna didn't reply, so I came out, drawing the door to behind me. The following morning, Tuesday, when I took Anna into school, I checked with Miss Rich that she knew of the change in arrangements for Wednesday, that Anna was being collected by her parents. She did. Elena telephoned the school and spoken to Mrs. Taylor. Miss Rich also said that the educational psychologist would begin an assessment of Anna the following week. That was positive, although I knew it could take many months before her report would be complete and available. However, not only would her recommendations help to identify Anna's learning difficulties, but they would also give directions on what further support was needed for her in the classroom, so she could return to school full time. Anna didn't mention the therapist or her parents again, so on Wednesday morning I reminded her of what was happening that afternoon.
"Don't care,"
she said, but deep down I knew she did. It was another symptom of her condition, that she couldn't show love or concern, and appeared cold and uncaring. I was hoping the therapist would address that too. Wednesday was also the 1st of June, signalling the start of the summer months, and the weather obliged by turning very warm, a heat wave, the like of which surprises us in the UK every year. The children went to school in their summer uniforms, and I was pleased to be able to wear a cotton dress and sandals. The birds were singing and the flowers blooming, and everyone I met was in a very good mood. What a difference clear blue skies and sunshine make! Some days there is precious little of them. I took Anna into school and confirmed, with Miss Rich, that her parents would be collecting her and bringing her back to me later. Then I said goodbye and returned home. After a cup of coffee, I set about the list of jobs I had to do and made good progress. Not having to leave at 1:30 to collect Anna gave me nearly an extra 2 hours, although Anna was never far from my mind. I wondered what sort of day she was having at school, and if the change in her routine and the prospect of seeing her parents and the therapist had unsettled her. It was nearly 6 months since she'd last seen her father. At 4:45, Adrian, Paula and I were sitting on the patio in the shade and enjoying a cool drink, when through the open patio doors we heard the front doorbell ring. They knew that Anna had a hospital appointment and her parents would be bringing her home. I'd also told them that her parents might come in, so we needed to keep the living room reasonably tidy.
Adrian and Paula stayed where they were as I went to answer the front door. A man I recognised from the photo in Anna's room stood alone in the porch. "Cathy Gloss?"
"Yes. Hello. You must be Ian."
He shook my hand, but it seemed more out of politeness than warmth.
"Where's Anna and Elaine?" I asked, looking past him.
"They're waiting in the car, just up there," he said, pointing to the road behind my neighbour's hedge.
Tall, with broad shoulders, he was wearing grey trousers and a white shirt, left open at the neck. The heat of the day beat down into the porch, and his expression was serious.
"Are they coming in now?" I asked,
but even as I spoke, fear gripped me.
"No, Anna's not coming in," he said. "We're taking her home with us."
Chapter 26 Missing Her. I stared at Ian and he looked back.
"What do you mean?" I asked.
"I'm sorry this has come as a shock for you, but we're taking Anna home. I've just phoned the social worker and told her, and that we've come here to collect some of her clothes."
"But Laurie hasn't phoned me," I said.
"She won't have had time. Can you pack what Anna needs, please, so we can get her home?"
I hesitated. I'm not good at making snap decisions. I need time to weigh up the pros and cons, but I didn't have the luxury of time now. Had Anna been the subject of a care order, then I would have called the police, as Ian and Elaine would have had no legal right to remove her from my care, but that wasn't so with a Section 20.
"You'd better come in," I said to Ian, opening the door wider, "but I'll need to speak to Laurie first."
"I understand," he said.
He stood in the hall, clearly as uncomfortable as I was by what was happening. I picked up the phone on the hall table. With unsteady fingers, I keyed in Laurie's number, and thankfully she answered straight away. "It's Cathy."
"Are they there now?" she asked tightly.
"Ian is with me in the hall. Anna and Elaine are outside in the car. They want to take Anna home now. Ian said he'd spoken to you. He's asking me to pack some of Anna's belongings."
Ian was staring at the floor.
"I told them I wanted Anna left with you for now, but they're insisting on taking her," Laurie said. "I'm leaving the office now to go to their house. Hopefully I can talk some sense into them and then return Anna to you later."
"Do you want me to pack a bag for her?"
"Easier to, but just a small one. I'll call you later."
As I replaced the handset, Adrian and Paula came into the hall looking concerned, having heard Ian's voice.
"Hello,"
Ian said awkwardly to them.
"This is Anna's father," I said. "Could you two go and play outside for a while?"
Appreciating that there was something serious going on that required my full attention and their cooperation, they did as I asked.
"I'm sorry," Ian said to me.
I looked at him. "Ian, it would be so much better for Anna if she stayed here for now, as Laurie suggested. Then, if it's decided she should return to you, we can do a planned move. It would be far less unsettling for her." He shook his head, a bit like Anna did.
"We've spent enough time apart. I don't know what I was thinking of going off like that after Christmas. I want us to be together again as a family. I've told Laurie we can deal with whatever comes."
I'm sure he genuinely believed that to be so, but they hadn't been able to deal with Anna before.
"Did you see the therapist this afternoon?" I asked.
He nodded. "What did she say about Anna going home?"
"We didn't discuss it. It was a decision Elaine and I made afterwards."
"Ian, it's all too quick. Believe me, this isn't the best way forward for Anna or any of you. She'll be even more troubled than before."
"Please, just do as I ask and pack a bag with what she needs," he nearly begged. "I'll collect the rest another time."
He was very close to tears.
"All right. It'll take me a few minutes. Do you want to sit down?"
I meant the living room, but he sat on the chair in the hall by the telephone table.
"Would you like a glass of water?"
He'd gone very pale.
"Yes, please."
I quickly fetched him a glass of water from the kitchen and handed it to him.
"Are you okay?"
He nodded and rubbed his hand over his forehead.
"I'm sorry. It's been a very difficult day. I'll be better once we're home and settled."
Leaving him in the hall, I went upstairs,
took the smallest of Anna's bags from the top of the wardrobe and set about packing the essentials. Her toothbrush, flannel and so forth from the bathroom, her pyjamas, dressing gown, underwear, socks, and a set of casual clothes from her bedroom. She didn't have a favourite soft toy that she took to bed, so I packed one of the teddy bears from her shelf, although I was expecting her to be returned later by lorry. She was wearing her school uniform, and I packed another set. Then I returned downstairs and passed the bag to Ian.
"Thank you," he said, getting up from the chair. "I am sorry I've caused you so much trouble."
"It's not me I'm worried about," I said. He turned towards the door to let himself out, then, as an afterthought, said,
"Do you want to say goodbye to Anna?"
"Yes, please." I was sure it wouldn't be goodbye, but I wanted to see Anna to check she was all right and let her know I wasn't abandoning her. Leaving the front door on the latch, I followed Ian out to his car. He opened the rear door, pavement side. Elaine and Anna were sitting together in the back, still under their seat belts. Elaine had obviously been crying, her eyes were red, but Anna stared at me, blank and confused.
"Hello, love. Are you okay?" I asked gently. "I'm not living here any more," she said.
I glanced at Elaine, who had the decency to look embarrassed.
"I've told the social worker," Elaine said. "She's coming to see us later."
"I know. I've just spoken to her. But, Elaine, this is not..."
I didn't get any further.
"Don't say anything," she said, holding up her hand, her eyes filling. "It's difficult enough as it is. I don't need a lecture."
"I wasn't going to lecture you. I just want what's best for Anna."
"So do we,"
she said sharply. The boot closed with a thud. Ian had stowed away Anna's bag. He went to the driver's door. What could I say to Anna? It wasn't goodbye, but I couldn't say see you later, as that was likely to confuse her more and antagonise Elaine and Ian.
"Take care, love," I said. Instinctively, I reached in and put my arms around her. To my amazement, she didn't pull back, but hugged me. Our very first hug as she was being taken away. And a lump rose in my throat.
"Bye, Kathy," she said in a small voice, relaxing her arms. "Say goodbye to Adrian and Paula. I'll miss them."
Another first, and an indication of just how upset and vulnerable she must have been feeling. It broke my heart.
"Time to go," Ian said from the front.
"Take care,"
I said to Anna. Straightening, I closed the car door. Ian started the engine, but then had to reverse before he had enough room to pull out. As he did, I looked at Anna through the glass in her side window, and a tear rolled down her cheek. The first tears of sorrow she'd ever shown me as the enormity of what was happening hit her. Before, her tears had been from rage at not getting her own way. Elaine and Ian had acted on impulse, believing they were doing the right thing, but had caused their daughter more upset and turmoil, although I'm sure they didn't see it that way. The car pulled away. I returned indoors and straight away telephoned Jill. She was on another call and a colleague said she'd ask her to phone back as soon as she'd finished. Adrian and Paula, having heard the front door shut, appeared in the hall again, looking even more worried.
"Where's Anna?"
Adrian asked.
"Her parents have taken her home with them for now. Don't worry, the social worker will sort it out. Although I might be on the phone for a while."
I glanced at my watch. "I'll put some dinner in the oven, and I'd like you two to be really big and amuse yourselves quietly."
"Did Anna want to go with them?" Adrian asked.
"I don't know, but it wasn't the right thing to do, to just take her. Her social worker will bring her back later."
Anna wasn't the only one to be unsettled by suddenly being removed. Adrian and Paula had experienced many changes during our years of fostering, but none as abrupt as this. I didn't get as far as the kitchen before the telephone rang. It was Jill returning my call.
"Anna's parents have taken Anna home," I said. "Laurie is going there now to talk to them and then return Anna later."
"When did this happen?"
"Just now. Her parents collected her from school and took her to therapy as arranged, but then suddenly decided that they wanted to be together as a family. Ian phoned Laurie and then they stopped by here to collect her things."
"Have you spoken to Laurie? Yes, I phoned her straight away. She said to just pack a small bag. Elaine and Anna didn't come in, but I saw them in the car.
Oh, the poor kid. She didn't need this right now. She was just starting to settle with you.
I know, but there was nothing I could do.
I'm not blaming you.
So Laurie is going to contact you once she's seen the parents?
Yes, that's what she said.
Okay, I'm on call tonight, so will you phone me when you hear from Laurie? I'll need to speak to her too.
The agency provided emergency out-of-hours cover every day of the year. A child being taken from a foster carer without notice was an emergency. I made a quick dinner with enough for Anna, and once it was ready, I called Adrian and Paula to the table. Everyone was very subdued, and I didn't have much of an appetite, although Adrian and Paula ate. Chicken nuggets and chips were an occasional treat when I didn't have time to cook a proper meal. After we'd finished, they returned to the garden, while, with one eye on the clock, I cleared away. I was on tenterhooks waiting for the phone to ring, or even the front doorbell to go if Laurie didn't phone before bringing Anna home. Social workers have so much on their mind sometimes, they forget to call the foster carer to say they're on their way with an approximate time of arrival. Then at 6:30, Jill telephoned to see if I'd heard anything, which I hadn't.
"Me neither," she said. "I've left Laurie a voicemail message asking her to phone me as soon as she is able. If she calls you first, can you let me know?"
"Yes."
The phone didn't ring again until nearly 7:30, when I was in Paula's room reading her a bedtime story. I left her and took the call on the extension in my bedroom. It was Laurie.
"I'm still with the family," she said. "I've agreed that Anna can stay here tonight. It will be less unsettling for her than coming back to you now it's getting late."
"Oh, okay."
Clearly it was Laurie's decision.
"Is Anna all right?"
"She's the quietest I've ever seen her,"
which wasn't the same thing and did nothing for my concerns.
"I'll be in touch with you and Jill tomorrow," Laurie said. "Can you tell Jill what's happening? She left a message."
"Yes, I will. Is Anna with you now?"
"No, she's upstairs with Elaine, unpacking her bag."
"Can you say good night to her from me, please?"
"Yes, of course.
I'll speak to you and Jill tomorrow."
We said goodbye and I slowly replaced the handset, all manner of thoughts going through my head. I had no idea what had happened to lead to Laurie's decision, although I appreciated that it would have been very late if Laurie had returned Anna tonight, especially if she had needed persuading. But on the other hand, surely leaving her there was going to make it more difficult to bring her back to me tomorrow. I tried to picture Anna and Elaine unpacking Anna's bag, and Elaine seeing her into bed. What would Elaine do when Anna kicked off and refused to stay in her bedroom? Would she be firm, or would she and Ian let Anna into their bed and go right back to square one? It was behaviour like this that had led to Anna going into care in the first place. I now telephoned my fostering agency, and after a few rings, Jill answered.
"Jill, it's Kathy. Laurie has just called and has decided to leave Anna with her parents for tonight, as it is getting late."
"I see. Is she going to return her to you tomorrow, then?"
"I assume so, although she didn't say when, just that she'd phone."
"Well, there's nothing else you can do now, so I'll speak to Laurie as soon as I can tomorrow. I'm dealing with two runaways right now, one of whom is only 10. Speak soon."
We said a quick goodbye and I returned to Paula's room to find her fast asleep. Downstairs, I told Adrian that Anna was spending the night at her home with her parents and would be back tomorrow, which he accepted. Without Anna to see to, I had extra time to spend with him, and I made the most of it. We chatted and played a board game, although Anna was never far from our thoughts. Adrian mentioned her a few times, clearly concerned for her. That night, when I went up to bed, I stopped off in Anna's room to close her bedroom window as a storm was brewing after the heat of the day. It was strange and slightly unnerving, standing there surrounded by her belongings with no Anna tucked up in bed, and again my thoughts went to her house and how they were all faring there. Doubtless Laurie would tell me when she returned Anna tomorrow. I looked at the framed photographs on the bookshelf of Anna's parents and her birth mother, and then, straightening the duvet, came out. It was even stranger the following morning without Anna when I woke Adrian and Paula.
There was an unnatural calm, and I found I had extra time as I didn't have to keep telling Anna what she needed to do or not do. Our routine ran very smoothly, but we missed her. I told Paula as she dressed that Anna had spent the night at her house with her parents.
"I thought I couldn't hear her," she said.
"No, the house is quiet."
"I can change that," Adrian called, having overheard. He then yelled nonsense at the top of his voice for a good minute until I told him enough was enough.
Anna's empty chair at the breakfast table was disconcerting, and although there wasn't the usual constant pressure to make sure she did as I asked, we would much rather have had her there.
"When's Anna going to come home?" Paula asked.
"Later today, I think," I said.
"I'll let her play with my doll," she offered.
I knew which doll Paula was referring to, and that this was a very generous gesture. The week before, Anna had purposely pulled the arms off the doll, and I'd repaired it as best I could. I was aware that when Anna did return, it was likely her behaviour would have deteriorated from the upset of all the recent changes. It was another fine, sunny day. The storm that had been forecast the night before hadn't materialised, so not needing to take Anna to school in the car, Adrian, Paula and I walked to school. Having seen them in, I returned home and began tidying up, all the while listening out for the phone. At 10:15 it rang. "Mrs. Glass?" A woman's voice I didn't recognise. "Yes, speaking. It's the school secretary. Miss Rich is with me. Is Anna not coming into school today?"
"Oh, isn't she there, then?"
"No, didn't you know?"
I heard her concern.
"I'm sure she's all right. Anna stayed with her parents last night. They must have decided not to bring her into school today. You'd better phone them for confirmation."
"I'll tell Miss Rich," she said. "And just a reminder that if a child is absent, we expect the parent or carer to phone in and let us know before the start of school."
"Sorry," I said. Although, of course, I didn't know Anna hadn't gone to school. It had been her parents' responsibility to notify the school.
"Will Anna be in tomorrow? Miss Rich is asking," the secretary said.
Yes, I would think so. I should be bringing her."
"Thank you. I'll let Miss Rich know."
We said goodbye.
But why wasn't Anna in school, I wondered. Had she been too upset or refused to go? Or was there another, more sinister reason? It wasn't for me to telephone the parents to find out, but I would tell Laurie when she phoned. With one eye on the clock, I continued with various jobs and the morning ticked by. Just after 12, the phone rang and I quickly answered it, hoping it was Laurie or Jill with news of Anna. It was Anna's teacher, Mrs. Taylor.
"Whatever is going on?" she asked, concerned.
"Lauren Rich tells me that Anna didn't return to you last night and is staying with her parents."
"Only for last night," I said. I then went over what had happened since Anna had been collected from school by her parents the afternoon before to go to therapy. When I'd finished, Mrs. Taylor let out a heartfelt sigh.
"What a mess! I'm sure her parents don't realise the harm they are doing. I always hoped Anna would go home eventually, but this is not the way to do it."
I agreed.
Chapter 27 Bad Ending. By 1:30 p.m., when I still hadn't heard from Jill or Laurie, I telephoned my fostering agency and then waited for Jill to finish the call she was on.
"Sorry," she said as she came on the line. "It's Manic here. I haven't had a chance to speak to Laurie. Do you know the arrangements for bringing Anna back?"
"No, I haven't heard from Laurie. That's why I'm phoning."
"Okay, I'll call her now and get back to you."
"Jill, can you tell her Anna isn't in school today? I'm not sure if she knows. Also, remind her I shall be out between 3:15 and 3:45 collecting Adrian and Paula from school. I don't want her and Anna arriving to an empty house."
"Will do."
Another nail-biting wait followed, and it was nearly an hour before the phone rang again. I answered in the living room. It was Jill.
"I've only just managed to speak to Laurie. Anna isn't coming back to you today."
"Why not?" I exclaimed.
"The parents are adamant that Anna should stay with them. Ian has moved back in, and now they're in therapy. They say they can cope with her."
"But therapy won't change things that quickly," I said with dismay.
I know. Laurie has concerns, so she is arranging a case conference, hopefully tomorrow, to decide what to do. You don't have to go. They could return Anna to you straight after, but you need to prepare yourself for the other decision, too.
What? That Anna might not come back?
Yes. Given that there is no suggestion the parents have abused or neglected